Well, already, gang, welcome back to the Gutowski Files, starring Stephen Gutowski. Stephen is the founder of TheReload.com, editor-in-chief, owner of TheReload.com, and the host of the weekly Reload podcast. Fun fact, folks, we do read your reviews, we read your comments, and this may sound like I'm talking about sports, but I'm not talking about sports. I'm talking about people talking about the fact that we're not talking about sports. Did you get that a lot, Stephen? You with me?
There you go. We just get more convoluted each episode about this.
So real quick, I just want to, we get some comments. I'm going to read these over here. They're off to the side. This from High G Flyer, November 30th. Thank you so much for not talking sports at the start of the show. I had my finger on the fast forward button to skip ahead, but didn't have to. You and Steve are both fantastic, and thanks for sparing us that buddy sports talk. Thank you for the comment. And then someone named me, /43275, says, thank you for putting sports at the end. So we appreciate the comments. We appreciate the feedback. Stephen, you even got some feedback on your end about this podcast, not talking about sports, right?
Yeah. Well, they liked that we talked about sports. The email that I got from a listener who said they weren't a sports guy, but they like the length too. We don't keep it too long. Just a little, you know, just give a little bit of personality in there. I think it helps.
So remember, if you're getting ready to write a negative comment, we are not talking about sports right now, just for the record. That's, we want to be super clear. All right, enough about that.
Yeah. So what are we talking about?
Well, one of the things we're talking about is you, sir, and this is relevant to the Second Amendment community, you've applied for a permit. Talk to us about that. And it's kind of exciting. Something that, you know, 20 years ago when I lived around that area, it never would have occurred to me would even ever be possible. So tell us about what is your going on, you got going on over there.
Yeah, no, I finally was able to put in my application for my DC concealed carry permit. You know, they changed the law. DC was kind of a canary in the coal mine situation when it came to these concealed carry laws, what used to be called may issue laws, had this subjective standard in them, which in practice meant that almost nobody could actually get a concealed carry permit in a lot of these jurisdictions that right. Like New York and there's about eight other states, California, Maryland, Massachusetts, Hawaii, the sort of deep blue states you'd expect. That was the subject of the Supreme Court's ruling last year in Bruin, which we will also get to a little bit later in this mm-hmm. episode. But before that happened, there was a case called Wren v. DC that was basically the same thing where they sued over this type of permitting process that effectively meant most people couldn't get a permit. And that won, and they put in place they used to have a total ban on gun carry in DC.
I remember. You couldn't even own a gun in your house in DC.
Well, that was Heller, right? Was about the handgun ban. Then they used to, but they still, after Heller, had a ban on concealed carry, on any kind of carry. There was no way to legally carry a gun in DC for decades, really. And then that outlasted Heller until that got struck down. And then they put in a may issue system, and then that got struck down too. The DC's laws get struck down quite a lot, the gun laws, because they're always trying to push the boundaries there. But so, long story short, I took the test that you need, or the training that you need to get this permit. They have their own special requirements. This is sort of, again, another way that they're kind of ahead of the curve mm-hmm. on how they responded to this ruling. I would say it was actually more, they haven't had too many issues with their latest law that they passed a couple years back, pre-pandemic, that had at the time, I think, set the strictest, among the strictest at least, requirements for what you had to do to get the permit. Mm-hmm. But it became shall issue, which means they had to give it to you if you go through the process. You pass a background check, you do the training that they require. And so, you know, it's a 16-hour class with 2 hours of range time. You know, there's a fingerprinting process. There's an application process that takes forever. So what I did today was drop off my application.
Okay.
And I did this. I took the class back in April, I believe, or the... it's right. The beginning of April, I think, is when I got my certificate. And then you have to, one thing they do to stretch out the time frames on this stuff in DC, and you see this in other places sometimes too.
Look at EU New York.
Yeah. Or even Philadelphia has tried these things. And, right. But they run into more problems because Pennsylvania's laws are a little bit more forgiving to applicants, and Philly's always trying to put extra steps in the way. But But they often don't get away with doing that. Whereas DC or New York or California or some of these other jurisdictions where the governments, the state governments much more, or the district government in this case, is much more in favor of restricting guns, they put a lot of extra barriers in the way. And to get rid of them, you have to go to court and probably have to get all the way up to the Supreme Court in a lot of these situations. So, but yeah, they make you set an appointment to drop off your application. And so I did that after completing the training process. And it was 3 months to get an appointment. This is just to drop. This is the thing I did today, was just drop off the application. Now, unfortunately for me, I also had to reschedule that twice, because the first time that happened right as my Virginia permit was expiring, and I hadn't gotten the new piece of paper from Virginia yet to take in and show that, because you have to have proof that you have a permit where you live if you're not a DC resident.
Right.
And so I had to reschedule that. And then when it was up the next, that was 3 months again. And then after that was when I had to go up to the farm because of the escaped murderer. The day I was supposed to go and drop off my application was the same day that the guy ended up within, you know, walking distance of my mom's house, the escaped murderer up in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So I had to reschedule again. And today is the day that I got to drop off my application, which does not mean that today is the day that I get my actual permit.
Did you actually just literally walk into a place and hand it to someone? That was it? Or was there at least an interview or something?
No, there wasn't any interview or anything like that. They took my picture. I'd already done the fingerprinting. They require fingerprinting. And I'd already done that for, it's a long story, but I wrote about the process back when they had a May issue system, and I went through it and got denied and all that stuff. But they did take my fingerprints at the time. And so they still have my fingerprints. They haven't changed. So they didn't make me redo the fingerprints. They just took my picture. They just had me sit there while they looked at my application, I guess, in the back. They're very nice. Nothing, you know, the people processing and stuff are nice, but yeah, no real reason I had to be there in person. But that's how that's one of the things they make you do. You take, an hour and a half out of your day to go and sit and wait in a waiting room. There are a bunch of people there doing the same thing as me.
That bothers me on multiple levels, by the way. Can I ask you, the audience, write in if you feel like safer now, you feel more safe that the Washington DC government is protecting us from the likes of Stephen Gutowski walking the streets of DC with a loaded firearm. Thank God that we don't have to worry about what, wait a minute. Have you ever smoked crack?
Also,
I want to ask you, have you ever smoked crack? I've never smoked crack.
No, I feel like you're transitioning to our next story.
I'm trying to, yeah, but go ahead. You have more to say about this.
Yes, that will be relevant in a moment. I have never smoked crack in my life, but which I think is an important detail for this process. I'm sure they would want to know if I was using crack. But I don't get the permit for 60 to 90 days, by the way. That's the processing time. And I've heard, I don't know how quickly it goes now, but in the past I've heard sometimes they'll just ignore that, the deadlines. So who knows when I'm actually going to get the permit. And the permit's only good for 2 years. So you got to renew every 2 years, is my understanding. And they also have a lot of restrictions. They instituted a lot of gun-free zones. They have some pretty crazy ones, honestly. They were sort of the forefront of this idea that has taken over in these deep blue jurisdictions since Brunetti. They don't have what people call the vampire rule. Right, which is where people call it that because vampires have to be invited in to your home in order to enter, right? And so this the rules in a lot of these states, and it was actually one of the ones that was blocked in the Second Circuit ruling recently against New York's law. But there's generally speaking, the presumption has always been that as long as it's publicly accessible private property, you can carry a gun there unless they post a sign that says you can't.
Right.
Well, obviously this rule flips that on its head. So they'd have to give you permission to enter a store or a restaurant or something like that. If you're carrying, otherwise it'd be a crime. Now DC doesn't do that, but they do lots of other ones. They have some their thing about restaurants is really weird. That it's, you have to like look up the alcohol license that they have to see if it's a bar or tavern or a restaurant. I think that's just meant to be like some states that have, you know, a ban on if a place serves, if, you know, 50% of their revenue comes from alcohol, you can't carry that. Some states have that. So it's not super out of the ordinary. It's pretty weird way of enforcing a rule like that, but hard for somebody to comply with. But I guess we'll see how that works in practice. But they also have roving gun-free zones. So one of the things in these new laws is the demonstrations, right? Protests have like a roving gun-free zone around them in a lot of these jurisdictions. That comes from this DC law where they first did that. They made a lot of specific areas like the mall, the National Mall is off limits to carry, and like a buffer zone around it. So you can actually live in that. I think I know people who live within this buffer zone. Wow. And it's like, what are they supposed to do? And then there's also a diplomat. Is anyone under diplomatic protection? So like if the president drives by you in the motorcade, they have a roving gun-free zone that follows them around too. So you can't get within a certain distance of them.
So if you see the president coming, you have to run away.
That is kind of the implication. Yeah. If you see them coming, if you see a motorcade coming, you got to run away from them, which
three blocks at the minimum.
Feel like makes you really suspicious, but I do think there's they kind of have to warn you before they can arrest you on that stuff.
Right.
So I think in practice, I'd be real surprised if anyone's ever been arrested under this provision, but it's just like their metro ban, the subway system here in DC. Virginia, if you have a permit, you can carry in Virginia on the metro. DC, you can't, even with a permit. And that's been challenged a couple times, but no one's ever actually been arrested under this law. So they keep ruling, the federal judges keep ruling that the people who are suing have no standing because they haven't been arrested, because nobody's been arrested.
And if people aren't from DC, it's kind of like New York, in as much as the vast majority of people who work in DC live in Maryland or Virginia, and the vast majority, I'd say more than half of them probably use the metro to get into the district every day, because driving into DC on a daily basis and driving home is absolute nightmare. It's one of the things a lot of folks don't know about the DC area is the traffic is abysmal. That would definitely put a hitch in your giddy up if you couldn't, you had to get off on the metro stop just outside of DC or whatever. The point I'm trying to make here is all this stuff is, I think, intentionally complicated and silly. And, you know, the idea of a roving, gun-free zone or the National Mall, like, how is this helping anyone, practically speaking, to be safer by making the National Mall a giant gun-free zone? Are we saying that someone who has designs to go to the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and shoot people is going to say, oh, can't do that, I can't bring my gun in there? I mean, it just seems very, very, very silly to me.
You know, and I do feel like going through the process that this is just my personal opinion, obviously, but it does feel designed to be burdensome, to make it so that people don't want to go through it.
Right.
DC doesn't want people to own guns. A lot of the lawmakers in DC don't like guns. They don't want people to own them. They think that's the root of their gun violence issue, is just the existence of guns. And so I think from their perspective, the fewer guns in the city, the better. And they just don't see that distinction that a lot of gun owners and gun rights advocates do between people who follow gun laws and people who don't. And I
know this is cliche. I understand this is cliche and it's a little pat, but frankly, the people we're talking about that are making these decisions, many, if not most of them, if not all of them, have armed guards. They have people who follow them around with guns to keep them safe. And I know, again, that's a bit of a cliche, but it happens to be true. I mean, most of the people they're running there, making these decisions are DC City Council, the DC mayor, then Congress has a hand in as well. All those people have 24-hour armed protection. Maybe that's everyone else does.
President Biden's granddaughter was, somebody just tried to carjack her in DC. But there was a armed Secret Service agent that shot the person. And my thought was, I drive in DC too, and it'd be great if I had an armed Secret Service agent come around with me everywhere.
Sure.
But I can't have that. So I'd like to be able to have, my own firearm for self-protection. I don't mind, going through some reasonable process to, you know, and obviously people have different political opinions on what the process should be and all that stuff. But a lot of this does feel like it's designed to be cumbersome. There's no real need for me to go down there to drop off these pieces of paper that I could easily email them. You could even get even if I don't know what purpose fingerprinting serves, frankly, in the process, but if they need my fingerprinting, you can get fingerprinted at lots of different places for lots of different purposes. There's no need to do it at the police station. And so, you know, and then these processing times, you know, setting up a system where I have to wait 3 months just to drop off my application
is intentional.
There's no logical reason why that should be. And then taking 60 to 90 days to do what? What are they doing exactly? All they got to do is perform a background check, which from anyone who's bought a gun at a gun store knows can happen instantaneously.
Done pretty darn quickly.
And what, I guess, verify my training certificate. And I presumably you could just, I mean, it's just a document signed by one of the trainers that has a certification. So just look up the trainer or even have some system where you reach out. I wonder if they even do that. Right. I mean, I doubt they do, but why would it take 90 days?
Yeah. So we've established that you do not smoke and never have you smoked crack in your entire life, which does lead us into our next story. Also, speaking of Secret Service protection, the story over at the Reload is by contributing writer Jake Fogelman, who I have yet to meet or have on the show, but let's remind me to talk about that. I want to have
him. We do need to do that.
And the title of the article is Hunter Biden argues gun charges unconstitutional and push for dismissal. And I called this novel and you corrected me and said, it's not really novel. Maybe it's ironic, but the idea that the president's wayward son, Hunter Biden, is now pushing this defense that if it works, could potentially be beneficial to other people in this situation who may not necessarily be Biden voters.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly was, say that it's remarkable, right? Just because of the dynamics of who's involved. You know, this president's son, the president himself is a very staunch gun control advocate who wants stricter gun laws. He wants more gun restrictions, not fewer. And his son is obviously now facing charges for lying on a background check in order to obtain a gun while being a unlawful user of drugs, specifically crack cocaine, which he got himself into this situation by basically writing a book and telling everyone that that's what he was doing at the time he had that gun. You know, there's a lot of remarkable things about this. And then, so that being charged alone is obviously going to be a news story. It's going to be a political story, but then now he is bringing up and he's actively making a Second Amendment defense to these charges that is not novel, which actually makes this story even more legitimate, right? More of a real story. Like there's a lot, you know, people make all kinds of legal arguments, or they'll bring up some legal argument and get a lot of attention, or and it may be a long shot thing. And it's not that this isn't a long shot thing necessarily, but it's something that is much more realistic today than it was 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Because of Bruin, right? The case that we just mentioned earlier, where the court established this new test for what kinds of laws are constitutional under the Second Amendment. And it's a test that's based on the history and tradition of firearms regulation in the United States, dating back to when the Second Amendment was written and adopted, right? That, you know, this is the whole sort of concept of originalism, where they're trying to look at, well, what did people think the Second Amendment meant when they adopted it in 1792, right? So in order for a modern prohibition like this drug one from federal law, which really doesn't date back very far at all, it's from the mid-20th century, right, the 1960s, the Gun Control Act, right? And in order for that to be considered constitutional, you have to find some sort of analog around the founding period that addressed a similar problem in a similar way, right? For a similar reason. And that's where you've seen a lot of legal fights in the lower courts on this. And you actually have a case pending before the Supreme Court right now that the Department of Justice, President Biden's Department of Justice, has asked the court to review. called Daniels, which deals with somebody who was arrested for having marijuana and a gun. And so that's why this case actually becomes even more like a legitimate news story. It's not just the shocking nature of, oh, it's the president's son and he's, right. you know, he's using these drugs and there's all this stuff around him that we don't need to get into everything, obviously, but you know, that becomes a sort of, there's a lot of sensational aspects to that story, but there's really a core to this case that is, I think is kind of surprising in how legitimate it is, like how much attention we actually should probably pay to it, because US v. Biden, which is the name of this case, which is going to ramp up in 2024, which is when Joe Biden is running for reelection, has a legitimate chance of actually impacting Second Amendment jurisprudence in the United States.
Yeah. In a meaningful way as well. Yeah. So, because if they decide, well, this law is unconstitutional for, you know, for Hunter Biden or for Daniels or anyone else for that matter, could affect other people. Because I guarantee you there are currently at least hundreds of thousands of prohibited possessors out there because they use marijuana medically or recreationally and happen to have a gun in the house. They may not even be a big, you know, quote unquote gun person. But technically, you're committing a federal felony. Is it a felony? I think it's a felony, right?
It's a felony for sure. Yeah. And you could be charged with multiple felonies. That's what happened to Hunter Biden, right? He's charged with three different felonies based off the same purchase. He's charged with possessing the gun as an unlawful drug user. He's charged with lying on the background check about being an unlawful drug user. And then he's charged with a third crime that's related to having the gun store owner, the FFL, the licensed dealer, retain this document that has a lie in it is the sort of the third. They're basically all the same action, but you can get charged multiple times. I mean, he really kind of, the prosecutor here is, if you might recall, right, they initially had a plea deal set up. They had an arrangement that they were going to, and it all fell apart when they got to court and the judge started scrutinizing it. Because it was this kind of strange, strange deal that predicated the gun charges on the tax charges in a way that the judge had never seen done before, and when she started asking questions, the whole thing kind of fell apart. Yeah, in front of that,
came down to like basically how much immunity he has for what sort of charges or something like that. I didn't pay that close attention, but I remember it being something to do with that.
Yeah, it was, and also had to do with like if. Who determines whether or not he violated the plea, because there was this, there's this component to where the judge would have to step in and she wasn't comfortable with that she had the authority to even do that. And so, you know, they put together this deal that just didn't make sense, I guess, once it got to actual court and it fell apart. And so, and part of it was Hunter Biden and his lawyers saying, I guess the prosecutor must've felt that they didn't, he was upset by the deal falling apart is what it seems like. And he kind of threw the book at Hunter in this case, which I'm sure that's something a lot of prosecutors will do in a lot of cases. If a deal falls apart, they're kind of like, all right, well,
we tried.
So here's what you get instead. Now, I also think that means perhaps maybe they'll be able to come to some sort of, agreement later on before this actually ends up in court. You can maybe talk about this. I think a lot of these federal cases, the vast majority of them end up with plea deals instead of going to court, right?
Yeah, we were just talking about, who was I talking about this to? Crikey, I can't remember. But the idea, I was on a seminar, a webinar with John last night for Firearms Legal Protection. And we were discussing federal criminal cases and expert witnesses and investigators. And one of the things that came up was, you know, and this is my input to this conversation, is, you know, generally speaking, an assistant U.S. attorney or a U.S. attorney, they will not take a case unless they are reasonably sure they can win it. So there's all sorts of cases that go by the wayside. The vast majority of federal, state, and local cases, criminal cases, are either dismissed, dropped, or pled out before there's any kind of a trial. So a trial is a pretty unusual thing.
Yeah.
Unless it's a murder case or something like that, where the person is just, there's no upside for them to plead. They're just going to go to jail forever and ever. But for a case like this, you know, cases I used to prosecute, not prosecute, but I would bring to a prosecutor, were frequently like border bus cases, not really complex investigations. These were just, you know, Stephen Gutowski shows up at the port of entry with 2 pounds of cocaine in the trunk and we catch him. And then I interview him and he goes to jail. And then if he goes to trial, we're going to charge him with possession of cocaine, transportation of cocaine, possession of cocaine with intent to distribute, and like 10 other things that all sound very similar to each other because they are. Yeah,
right.
So usually, and I would say, I don't think I've ever dealt with that particular charge. I'm sure I probably could have, but it never kind of never came up. It never occurred to us to charge somebody with that particular thing. But it would strike me, possession, a prohibited possessor for narcotics use would strike me more as a, not even as a main charge, more of a lesser included kind of a thing. Like it wouldn't be the one marquee charge on a charging sheet.
And that is according to some of the academics I spoke to about the, about how this charge gets used in practice. And this is something that Hunter Biden's lawyers have claimed, that he's the only one who's ever been charged this way in Delaware. I don't know if that's true. But their basic argument is that he wouldn't be charged this way if he wasn't for his last name and politics involved and all that. And to be fair, there, you know, this kind of charge is rarely used on its own. It's usually a lesser included charge, or it's usually something that, like you just outlined there, it's much easier to prove than maybe dealing drugs is, but you can get somebody on this lesser charge, when you can't get them on what you really want to get them on, I guess, or have
them lead to that lesser charge, because it's a less serious offense and there's less potential jail time or less of a fine.
At the same time, though, there is that Daniels case that I mentioned from the Fifth Circuit, where potentially going to make it to the Supreme Court soon. They haven't decided whether or not to take it yet, but that case again is just a guy who was found with a gun and marijuana in his car, and so it's not like it's never happened before, or that less famous people don't get charged with this stuff. It's just, there's some argument over, would he have gotten charged this way otherwise? What should somebody who didn't actually commit any sort of violent crime with a gun while they were, because that's what he's charged with, right? He's just charged with having a gun or lying on a background check about his drug use. He didn't actually... all the things that he's done or been accused of doing, he did get charged with a bunch of tax crimes separately from this. But he was never charged of trying to rob anybody or shoot somebody or anything like that. And that's probably one of the reasons he's gotten a little bit of support from some gun rights groups over this. The Firearms Policy Coalition, maybe a bit tongue in cheek, offered to help him. I mean, I honestly think they probably would help him if he agreed to it, because they agree with the principle of the argument at hand in this case. And I will say too, there may be some more incentive for Biden to go to trial in this particular case, on the gun stuff, at least if he can't work out some sort of deal to get all this, like he wanted to at the beginning, avoid jail time and all that stuff, if possible. If he can't get that, he may actually want to go to trial on these charges, just because the other thing that Bruin does is that it shifts the burden to the government. So this is why you've seen a lot of, like, the case in front of this court right now, Rahimi, that's just a regular criminal defendant who had a public defender as his lawyer, and it made it all the way to Supreme Court because, I think in large part, the burden when judges are set to decide these cases is supposed to be on the government to prove that there is a historical tradition of this kind of regulation. And so all you have to do as a defendant basically is say, we don't think there is, and then the government has to be the ones who go out and show that there is a tradition. And that can be hard with some of this stuff, even stuff that may be relatively popular today, these prohibitions on people addicted to drugs from owning guns. That may be a fairly popular policy. And, we haven't seen a lot of political advocacy against the overall law itself. You've seen some on the marijuana aspects, because marijuana, I think people view that as a less serious drug, right? And it's much more popular drug, and it's been decriminalized in a lot of places, as you alluded to earlier. Whereas crack cocaine is obviously not viewed that way. But under the law and in these rulings that you've seen, which have come down on either side of this question in the lower courts, whether or not this law is constitutional, there's no distinction between marijuana and crack cocaine under this law. So his legal argument is as good as the one in Daniels that won. So maybe, you know, maybe he does go to trial. Maybe it's, he does risk it because the burden is on the government in that situation.
Yeah, the very well could be. I mean, we could be looking at, you know, Hunter Biden, hero of the Second Amendment community. Wouldn't that be something?
You know, who knows? Something.
Stranger things have happened. We had another story we wanted to talk about real quick. We're running a little long, but I did want to get this in. Another article over at The Reload, this time by Stephen Gutowski, and that came out yesterday, December 12th. And it is entitled Smith & Wesson Sales Rise Again.
Smith & Wesson. That'd be a good. I'd buy from them.
I'm not having a stroke, I promise. Do not call 911. Smith & Wesson sales rise again. So why is that significant? Why should we care, Steve? Tell us.
Well, this is the second quarter in a row where you've seen Smith & Wesson's sales rise, and that's another barometer you can use for how the overall gun market is doing, because I think people overestimate how big the gun market is, right? There's really only two publicly traded gun companies in the United States. There's Smith & Wesson and Ruger.
Right.
And so if you're looking for financial statements that you can track how demand is going in the industry at large, those are kind of your two go-to places, because these other companies don't necessarily have to disclose their earnings reports every quarter. You don't get, you know, investors calling in and all the stuff associated with being a large publicly traded company. I mean, the first gun company we know of to do $1 billion in sales in a year was Smith & Wesson back in 2020, back during the surge in sales. And so $1 billion in sales is a lot of money to your eye, right? But it's pretty much a drop in the bucket for a lot of big companies that are publicly traded, right? I mean, what's Apple's, like a $1 trillion company, right?
Yeah, ridiculous. I just most valuable company in the world. And they make Smith & Wesson look like, well, I'll put it to you this way. If AirPods were its own company, it'd be like the eighth largest company in the world.
Right.
Just AirPods. So, yeah.
You know, so just it's just something to keep in mind when you talk about, I mean, that's, you think about guns. There's a lot of people own guns, right? 52% of voters in the most recent NBC poll that we talked about a little while back. But guns are not perishable items,
right?
They're durable goods, and there's that old saying of the only thing that is a threat to a gun or the only threat to your guns are politicians and rust, right? Like, because they'll last 100-200 years if you maintain them all right. So regardless, that is one way you can track how the industry is doing, how the demand for guns is going. And Smith & Wesson, after that record-setting year, had seen sales declines continually every quarter for like 2 years in a row. Mm-hmm. And just last quarter was the first time you saw them see a year-to-year increase in quarters in their sales. And so this is the second one in a row. It also comes after we had 2 months in a row where background checks, the National Institute of Criminal Background Check System, FBI checks that they do on gun sales increased year over year as well. So it's just more evidence that perhaps the market is rebounding, and, you know, it's or not necessarily rebounding, you know, it's not another spike. It's not a huge surge. These sales gains from Smith & Wesson are relatively modest. They're a couple percentage points over the previous years, the same quarter. They also have seen, it's not necessarily a sign that the industry, that Smith & Wesson in particular is doing really amazingly, because they've also had an increase in the cost of sales. So their profit margin was actually lower than it was year over year. And it's the same thing for the last 6 months, but it does show that demand is up again, and or that it's leveling out is more what I would say.
Right.
It's not declining anymore. What you tend to see in the gun market is big surges around some sort of chaotic event. You know, obviously 2020, you had several chaotic events in a row, the pandemic, the lockdowns, the George Floyd situation, the protests, the rioting, then the election, right? So all those things happened in 1 year, which is a huge motivator for a lot of people. And there are a bunch of motivators combined into one. So it's sort of perfect storm for gun sales situation. But But you usually see that happen. You see a big spike and then demand slows for a while. But usually it peaks out, or, you know, that demand floors out above the old highs that you saw in the, you know, before the spikes. And that does seem to be what's happened. If you look at the background check numbers, if you look at Smith and Wesson's, I got like a weird list for a second there. It's apparently hard name to say. Who knew? If you look at their sales, you'll see that sort of evidence of that, that, you know, they're still elevated from what they were in 2018, 2017, 2019, right?
So Smith and Wesson is back and Hunter Biden might save the Second Amendment. This is just one of those crazy weeks. Who would have seen any of this coming? Folks, do me a favor. If you are lamenting the lack of down the middle, sane, sober reporting on the Second Amendment and all things gun related, go over to thereload.com and consider getting a membership. Steven's doing great work over there. You can go to the website without having to pay a cent. Check it out. See what you think. But I highly recommend it. It's probably the best reporting on a specific topic there is going right now. And he needs membership fees, dues to fund his important work. So go over there and give him a look. Have a wonderful rest of your week. And as always, Steven, you have the last word.
I'm just glad that we ate up all that time so we don't have to talk about the Eagles this week. So I don't have any good things to say.
I'm not one of those people. I don't like gloating or gloaters, which is the most not Philly thing of all time to not enjoy gloating. But I don't like gloating, and I did feel a little bit bad. The Cowboys, though, of all the teams, I mean, good Lord. All right. Well, if you're listening from Dallas, we still love you, but go anyone but the Cowboys. And as always, Steven, you have the last word.
Absolutely.